Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps says it has launched a retaliatory missile attack on an Israeli center in Erbil, the capital of Iraq's Kurdistan region. Iranian parliamentarians demand sufficient political, technical, and economic guarantees from the United States in talks on the revival of the JCPOA. Day 18 of the Russia-Ukraine conflict. Russian forces launch a missile attack on a major military base in the west near the Polish border. I'm Behruz Najafi. Welcome. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says it's conducted missile strikes on a strategic Israeli center in the capital of Iraq's Kurdistan region. The IRGC says its precision strike missiles hit the center in response to the crimes of the Zionists. The IRGC has warned Israel of a strong and destructive response if it repeats its acts of aggression. Footage emerged on Sunday of explosions in the Iraqi city of Erbil. Media reports suggesting their target had been secret centers operated by the Israeli spy agency Mossad. It was also reported that the strike destroyed a building and killed several Mossad officers. Earlier this week, two Iranian military advisors were killed in Israeli airstrikes near the Syrian capital Damascus. Following that attack, the IRGC said Israel would definitely pay the price for its criminal act. Well, I talked to journalist and political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas, and he explained why Israel runs bases in Iraq's Kurdistan region in the first place. Let's take a listen.
Well, the big picture one must understand is that the Oded Yinon plan is still very much alive. It's a document that was produced a long while ago, but Greater Israel was its goal. You know, it constitutes the cornerstone of a powerful Zionist political agenda. And it's there within the military even today. It's there within the intelligence system. And even according to the founding father of Zionism, Theodor Herzl, the area of the Jewish state stretches from the Brook of Egypt to the Euphrates. And according to Rabbi Fleischman, the promised land extends from the River of Egypt up to the Euphrates, which includes Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, you know, large tracts of these territories. So when you view that reality, what's going on today in Iraq and what's happening there and the presence of Israel is absolutely of no surprise. And their purpose is to, it's multi-purpose really. One is to really create division, to have bases in the region where they can spread their division and their color revolution activities. They can also use these bases as training grounds for the likes of ISIS, which is another a beast which they directly are involved in nurturing along with the Americans.
The Iranian lawmakers have called for the ongoing negotiations in Vienna to result in an effective removal of all sanctions. Legislators say that the partial removal of sanctions on paper won't ensure the rights of the Iranian people. The MPs called on the negotiating team not to feel hamstrung by the fake deadlines set by the West and to follow up on Tehran's key demands without delay and ensure that its red lines are respected. They also urged negotiators to ask the American side for sufficient economic, technical, and political guarantees that Washington will not unilaterally withdraw from the agreement as it did last time. The parliamentarians underlined that any possible agreement must ensure Iran's economic benefits and the rights of people. The Saudi execution of 81 people in one day over alleged terrorism-related charges is drawing huge criticism. The Yemeni Committee for Prisoners of War has condemned the mass killings, warning of serious consequences for al-Saud regime. A number of Iraqi political movements, including Asaib al-Haq and Nojaba movements, also blasted the executions in the strongest terms. The killings took place on Saturday, with reports saying that some 40 of them were from the Shia-majority Qatif region. This is Saudi Arabia's highest number of recorded executions in a day. Among them were also members of the Yemeni Ansarullah movement. The Saudi Interior Ministry says that those executed were accused of deviant beliefs and collaboration with Daesh and Al-Qaeda terror groups. No court documents are available to verify those allegations. Now that many conflicts in the world are overshadowed by events in Ukraine, to avoid it, the International Committee of Red Cross urging the world not to shift away from Yemen. and those living through the years-long war in that country. In our news review program, my colleague has discussed that topic with our guests.
The International Committee of the Red Cross warns that the world must not forget Yemen and other war-torn countries as the conflict in Ukraine grabs everyone's attention. The head of the Red Cross delegation in Yemen, Katarina Ritz, said that the Ukraine must be added to all the crises currently taking place, but the focus must not shift to the European country. She said that the world should not lose sight of the plight of those living through the years-long war in Yemen. Ritz added that people's duty is to equally help everyone in need. Earlier, the UN's Children's Fund also warned of the situation in Yemen. UNICEF said that over 10,000 minors have so far been killed or maimed in the Saudi-led war since it began 7 years ago. 47 of the cases were recorded in the first 2 months of 2022 alone. Masoud Shajar is the head of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, who joins us from London. We also have Brian Terrell, who's a political commentator and peace activist, joining us from Molloy in Iowa. Welcome to you both. Masoud Shajar, what's happening in Ukraine in terms of civilian casualties obviously is something that is sad, to say the least. But when you have such massive media coverage, it makes you wonder how it is that a war that has claimed, I'm not too sure, maybe 100 times more civilian deaths does not get even close to that coverage. So it seems to be, obviously, there's a double standard there in the way that this is being covered in terms of the tally of deaths at a minimum.
It's absolutely shocking. It goes without saying that we are compassionate towards anyone who is in a war zone and is, as a civilian, are suffering. But, it's so shocking to see that there is complete undermining the values based on people. When we look at what is happening in Yemen, what is happening in Libya, in Syria, what has happened in Iraq, what has happened in Afghanistan, millions and millions of people have been killed, and no compassion to them whatsoever. And it's always been explained away as, look, this is a necessary evil, we have to implement democracy, human right of the people, we are there to protect them. And then they kill them. They kill them in the fields, they kill them everywhere. And now it seems that, completely there is a Alice in Wonderland sort of situation, that we are sort of seeing completely different standards. And they have no way of explaining this now, except based on racism, to say that these are blue eyes, blonde hairs, and therefore we need to look after them. I mean, even the train companies, which were instrumental in refugees dying because they couldn't get on the track, or they died trying to get onto the train, not giving free tickets to Ukrainians to actually come to Britain or travel around Europe. It's outrageous. It really is outrageous. And I think it really shows the principles behind colonialism, the principles behind the U.S. hegemony. They're not even ashamed of being so double standard and so racist and so aggressive. What does the Palestinians or Yemenis think watching what is happening today in Western Europe, who claims to be the flag bearers of human rights and justice and democracy?
Well, Brian Terrell, the Ukrainian President Zelensky has said that, we want to have talks, and has asked the U.S., can you be a little bit more proactive in helping us to achieve talks, to get somewhere when it comes to this? Well, in that respect, don't you think maybe that this should be a wake-up call for the U.S. perhaps, and other countries that are involved in different conflicts, to try to put that motion forward for those conflicts as well, whether it's Yemen, whether it's the Palestinian cause, whether it's in Libya, wherever else that there are conflicts. I'm guessing this would be a good starting point.
Yes, it would be. But I'm afraid what we're seeing is an influx of weapons made by American and European weapons manufacturers going into Ukraine, and only exacerbating the problem. Looking at Yemen, just over a year ago, his very first address on foreign policy as President of the United States, Joe Biden joined the world in condemning the war and the blockade of Yemen as a humanitarian disaster. And he said this has to stop and there will be no more support for the Saudi attack on Yemen. And a few months later, very quietly, a sale of missiles from made by Raytheon was approved to Saudi Arabia. I have to applaud the ICRC saying that we have to add the horrible things going on in Ukraine have to be added. Of course they do. The concern of the world has to be there. But how can we add it to all the others? And I hate to start listing them because you leave somebody out and that's horrible. Haiti, Congo, Gaza, Honduras, the border, the people who are dying in the desert of the United States and Mexico, refugees and the refugees who are dying trying to cross the Mediterranean. It's impossible, but what's not impossible is to stop these at their core, at their cause. The situation in Ukraine didn't have to happen. It's the encroachment of NATO that made this back in the 1990s. Everybody said, everyone, there's total agreement, including Joe Biden, the senator then, that we're headed for trouble if NATO expands. We have to disarm and we have to distribute the goods of the earth more fairly.
Thank you so much, Brian Terrell, political commentator and peace activist, and Massoud Shajar, a pleasure. Head of the Islamic Human Rights Commission from London. And with that, we come to an end for this news review.
Now moving on, while the world remains focused on Ukraine, many are accusing Israel of redoubling its violence and colonization efforts in Palestine. Observers say that the conflict in Eastern Europe is also being used as an excuse to censor pro-Palestine groups, as is the case in France. From Paris, Rami Mezahedi reports.
In Paris, demonstrators gathered to warn that while the world is distracted by the conflict in Ukraine, pro-Zionists are stepping up their violence and oppression against Palestinians worldwide.
A steady trend of murders. I mean, 2-3 teenagers assassinated per week. Hundreds, if not thousands, of olive trees uprooted. Houses demolished. Night arrests. It's going on continuously.
At the major pre-election dinner held by France's top Jewish lobby, known by the acronym CREEF, France's prime minister announced the banning of two pro-Palestinian groups. The administration of President Emmanuel Macron has falsely declared anti-Zionism to be the same as anti-Semitism and has already closed many of the nation's top Muslim and anti-racist organizations. Many around the world have been shocked at the swiftness with which the West is sanctioning Russia for its military operation in Ukraine, noting that nothing similar was even remotely attempted to help Yemen, Palestine, and so many other non-white conflict areas. Unlike Ukrainian refugees to the European Union, Palestinian refugees aren't being awarded visa papers, the right to work, medical care, rights to housing, and other social services.
In France, the government, almost all the media, all the political parties immediately stand for Ukraine. In a way, they launch in a minute a practical BDS, boycott, divestment, sanctions against Russia.
Western mainstream media and social media are openly encouraging armed resistance by Ukrainians against Russia. And yet resistance fighters in Palestine and other Muslim countries are called terrorists and subject to intense propaganda and censorship.
The double standards and Russophobia currently sweeping the West aren't just discrediting the West. They're providing a cover for far-right violence, oppression, and censorship. Many note that those aren't new policies for the West, and nowhere more so than in Palestine. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Now, Russia is carrying out the 18th day of its military campaign in Ukraine. Russian forces have hit a major military facility with missiles. According to regional officials, 8 missiles were fired at a base in western Ukraine, just 25 kilometers from the Polish border. The regional governor says the attack killed 9 people and injured 57 more. Russian forces also launched attacks at the airport in the western city of Ivano-Frankivsk. The defense minister says it has destroyed some 3,600 military facilities. In the capital, Kiev, residents woke up to air raid sirens this morning. The Russian forces have advanced closer to Kiev from the northwest and northeast. Ukraine officials cited attacks and threats of airstrikes are hindering attempts to evacuate civilians from surrounded areas. So far, nearly 2.6 million people, mostly women and children, have fled to neighboring countries. Now, in other news, millions of people across China are facing lockdowns amid a surge in COVID infections. The sharp rise in cases has prompted the authorities to close the schools in Shanghai, lock down central neighborhoods in the southeastern city of Shenzhen, as well as an entire city in the northeast. Almost 18 provinces are battling clusters of the Omicron and Delta variants. The latest flare-up has been driven by the highly transmissible Omicron strain and a spike in asymptomatic cases. China, where the virus was first detected in late 2019, has maintained a strict zero COVID policy, enforced by swift lockdowns, travel restrictions, and mass testing when clusters have emerged. And that's all we had for you for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترك همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of a speech delivered on February 17, 2022 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution via video conference with the participation of people from Tabriz and East Azerbaijan, commemorating the anniversary of the Tabriz uprising of February 18, 1978.
Today, training researchers and scientists is a long-term need. The issue of procreation and reproduction, which I have been emphasizing so much, is another example. Today, if we do not think about reproduction, then it will be late to solve the problem in 15-20 years. We will become a country that does not have enough of the necessary elements to move forward. That is, the youth. Today, we have to think about tomorrow. That is the youth. Today, we have to think about tomorrow. Another example is nuclear energy, on which the whole world is becoming increasingly dependent on a daily basis. We too need peaceful nuclear energy sooner or later. Today, if we do not think about it, if we do not follow the matter, it will be late tomorrow and our hands will be empty. When the world dominates all aspects of this issue, it will be difficult for us to move forward that day. So you see how cruelly the enemy front is focusing on the issue of our nuclear energy. They impose sanctions while they know that our nuclear energy project is peaceful. They say that Iran is such and such, an amount of time away from proceeding a nuclear bomb. These are nonsensical and meaningless remarks.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
They themselves know that we are not looking for nuclear weapons, and that we are only looking for the peaceful use of nuclear energy. They understand and know this. They do not want the Iranian nation to achieve this great and significant scientific progress, and they are putting pressure on us because the nation will need it tomorrow, and they do not want this movement to continue. If we fail to address these future and long-term issues today, we will face problems tomorrow. In the case of the JCPOA in 2015-2016, my objection was that certain points had to be observed so that no further problems would arise. My objection was mainly to this. I said to the officials that they had to consider certain points, and I frequently mentioned them in my recommendations. Well, some of those points did not receive attention, and therefore the subsequent problems that everyone is aware of arose. So looking to the future and being prepared for it is important.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
A two-day summit of European Union leaders in Versailles, France, to discuss Russia's military operation in Ukraine concluded with increasingly belligerent rhetoric possibly overshadowing the rejection of concrete sanctions. Led by the Eastern members of the bloc, the EU will not impose sanctions on Russian gas and oil. In mid-May, a proposal could be unveiled to phase out Russian fossil fuels by 2027. The Western members of the bloc led the swift rejection of Ukraine's appeal for fast-track membership to the bloc. The EU and NATO claim they have excluded direct military intervention in Ukraine. The EU did double to 1 billion euros the amount of military aid for Ukraine. It's the first such military involvement for the bloc, which was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2012.
There have been three strategic objectives which Russia did not anticipate. First, the resurrection of NATO. Second, the awakening of Europe. And third, the unity of Ukrainians. I think the Russians had a bad strategy.
Some in Europe are saying that Russia's military action is on the same level as 9/11 and that the EU must bolster cooperation on defense and drastically boost military spending.
Oui, l'Europe a besoin de s'armer.
Europe needs its own army. After the 1980s, Europe became disarmed and completely reliant on the Americans. Ukraine is the door to Europe, and now Europe has no choice but to arm itself. Europe needs to reconceptualize its own image into one where they can defend themselves.
If the EU follows through on some of these promises and sanctions, Europe will likely see a multi-year effect on prices of food, energy, and basic goods. The green transition, which some think is so vital, will likely need to be reversed. The summit ends much as it began. It's not fully clear how far the EU will go to get involved in the conflict between Russia and Ukraine.
A poll last month showed that two-thirds of France is favorable to organizing a referendum on leaving the European Union. If massive and controversial changes aren't approved by a democratic vote, it's possible that the EU may be fomenting even more discord. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
As Yemenis experienced the worst fuel shortage since the beginning of the Saudi-led war in 2015, Yemen's petroleum company held a press conference to highlight the impact of the Saudi piracy acts in the Red Sea.
In 2021, the Saudi-led coalition prevented entry of fuel needed to meet 95% of the general need for fuel. This shows that the Saudi-led coalition uses fuel as a pressure card amid the ongoing war. This is a clear violation of the international humanitarian law. The situation is dangerous, especially with the rise of oil prices internationally due to the Russian-Ukrainian conflict.
Officials say the purpose of the Saudi-led coalition seizure of fuel ships is to raise the price of fuel and spread chaos in the country.
The Saudi-led coalition is continuing its siege intending to raise fuel prices. They believe the rise in fuel prices will force people to go out to the streets and protest. But the Yemenis have proven to the Saudi-led coalition that they know who causes the fuel crisis, and they hold the United Nations responsible for its continued silence.
Besides the war, Saudi Arabia and its allies have imposed an all-out blockade on Yemen since March 2015. The United Nations describes Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis, but it has not taken any action to end the suffering of millions of Yemenis.
Experts believe Saudi Arabia's recent measures to block Yemen's fuel imports are yet another proof that the Saudi military operation against Yemen is a failure. And they also say the Russia-Ukraine conflict has exposed the international community's double standard on humanitarian crisis. Abdulatif Roshali, Sana'a.
Back on March 11, 2012, a U.S. Army sergeant horrifically killed at least 16 civilians, including 9 children, and wounded 6 others in Panjwayi district of Kandahar province. Today, Afghans recall the killings as shocking and inhuman, saying they can't forget about the U.S. war crimes in their country.
Around 10 years ago, a terrifying shooting was carried out on my relatives in the Zangawat village in Kandahar. It was like a nightmare. I can't forget it. American forces opened fire on civilians, including children and women. We did protests against the U.S. and didn't let them sweep it under the carpet. Americans should be held accountable for their war crimes in Afghanistan.
Sayed Ishaq Gilani was a former Afghan MP. He led the Afghan team to investigate the Panjwayi mass killing. He denies an individual act, saying it was planned and more Americans were involved.
Throughout our investigation, we found out that there was more than one shooter. We saw 20 footprints of the American forces at the scenes of crimes. The incident was shocking and tragic. It looked like a group of U.S. soldiers had done that. Then they blamed everything on one of their drunk teammates. The U.S. forces threatened the local people not to tell us the truth.
Sardar Muhammad, the lawyer of the victim's family, says that the U.S. Army threatened him and didn't let him pursue the file.
After the mass killing, the victim's family chose me as the lawyer. At a 2 rounds of trial, the American sergeant Robert Bales was sentenced to death, and it was what the family wanted. But before going to the last trial, Americans threatened me because I was insisting on execution of the murderer. I don't know what happened in the last trial, as the Americans selected one of themselves as the lawyer of the victim's families instead of me.
After 20 years of invasion, the U.S. and its allies hastily abandoned Afghanistan in mid-August last year, leaving Afghans with sad and heartbreaking memories. People in Afghanistan associate the U.S. invasion of their country with destruction, noise raids, and rights violation. They say the U.S. should be held accountable for its war crimes in Afghanistan. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
At the Palace of Versailles, famed as the seat of absolute autocracy and anti-democracy, the leaders of the European Union met in order to discuss possibly historic reversals of long-standing policies as a response to the conflict between Russia and Ukraine.
Une volonté de sortir de ce sommet avec une
The challenge is to leave the summit with a firm declaration that a peak of new sanctions is reached, that they will be applied, and that everyone is ready to move towards the same decisions, such as freezing assets of both the Russian central bank and private banks, sanctions on those close to Europe, and reducing gas purchases.
Russia is the biggest supplier of fossil fuels to the European Union, and the meeting will discuss how to reduce as much as 2/3 of its natural gas needs from Russia within a year. That is expected to be extremely painful for businesses and households, and would force a reversal of green energy policies, which many European politicians have insisted were of apocalyptic importance for many years. One of the key arguments often used to defend the EU is that it is responsible for an era of European peace. But many say the 2-day conference may provide the foundations for a new European army. For the first time, the EU has sent lethal weapons, even though the bloc won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2012. More than half of Europe has already sent arms to Ukraine, further escalating the conflict.
Une forme d'autonomie stratégique.
There needs to be a form of strategic autonomy, which Macron keeps repeating. And if not independence, then less dependence from both Washington and Moscow. The consequences of this conflict will be felt on Europe. So Europe needs to show unprecedented unity and swiftness.
To fund these changes, the leaders are discussing a potentially massive bond sale similar to the bloc's $2 trillion COVID rescue fund, and which they refused to do during the age of austerity. The latest round of Russia-Ukraine peace talks in Turkey failed to make any progress at all. The fallout from the conflict in the Ukraine is provoking massive shifts in historical developments and with a rapidity that few imagine possible. If the two countries can't make peace soon, the world may look very different very quickly. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Nigerians under the umbrella of the Concerned Abuja Indigenes said the Nigerian government's refusal to release the travel documents of Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki and his wife Zinat is part of the unjustifiable oppression of the Islamic cleric and his wife. The group said Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki has been brutalized in Zaria in December 2015, resulting in the murder of his 6 sons and thousands of his followers. They said the Islamic cleric has remained resolute and law-abiding, so there is need for the court to resolve the issue of his travel documents immediately.
Do we expect him dead before the judgment concluded? This is what we are talking about. If the court should keep on delaying, consigning the release of the traveling document, what do we do while the sickness keep on eating the body?
The Abuja Concerned Indigenes said Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki and his wife Zinat have dangerous levels of lead and cadmium in their blood and needed to be hospitalized. They said delaying the medical trip of Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zinat is an infringement on their rights.
The Constitution of Nigeria has given every individual a right to express, right of movement, right to medication, right of everything, socially. So if right has been given to every individual citizen of the country, why is Sheikh being deprived?
A Kaduna High Court had freed Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zinat since July 28, 2021. The Islamic cleric and his wife had dragged the Nigerian government to court over its refusal to release their passports to go for medical treatment abroad. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
Already struggling with the cost of living crisis, ordinary Europeans are now feeling the pinch at the pump, with the conflict in Ukraine pushing up the already high food and fuel prices. As plans to phase out oil imports from Russia are drawn up, the ripple effects of the Ukraine crisis are being felt across the continent.
Here in London, people are feeling the economic cost of the ongoing military conflict in Ukraine at the gas pump. Prices have been rising steadily since the start of the year and have now hit a record high. And what that means is that it's going to have a knock-on effect on the cost of transporting goods and, by extension, on the already rising cost of living.
Russia is the world's second largest exporter of oil. The EU imports 27% of its oil from Russia, the UK 11%, and the US just 8%, which is why Europe will feel the effect of the bans far more acutely than the US. The EU also plans to slash its dependency on Russian gas by two-thirds this year. That's 26% of their supply.
It's hard, bloody hard. But it's possible if we're willing to go further and faster than we've done before.
But to make it possible, experts say, the Europeans will have to make difficult compromises.
For the new government and Germany actually now saying, actually, we're going to bring back nuclear. Well, that was one of the key things, that they were going to get rid of nuclear completely, very quickly indeed. Then also coal, getting rid of the coal-burning power stations, and particularly those from maybe the using Polish coal, brown coal, which is incredibly dirty.
But could all this have been prevented? While the U.S. and Europe blame Russia's ongoing military offensive in Ukraine for the soaring energy costs, some experts say it's a crisis that could have been averted.
One of the great things about international affairs is to understand not just what you want to achieve, but what the other side wants to achieve. And where's the middle path? Russia generally would want to have a working relationship to protect its security, to make sure its confidence is there, and you know, instead of necessarily having people who are American allies literally a few hundred miles away from your capital, that's something they're not used to. So really understand their nervousness, now try and work out how to deal with it. But we've left it too late.
The new plans will mean less oil revenues for Russia and a faster transition to cleaner energy. But what it also means is a higher risk of inflation and recession across the continent. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Iran has launched its futures contracts for the first time in the history of its energy exchange market. The futures contracts were launched for the naphtha and methanol trades. According to experts, futures are some very important instruments for the market balance. If other energy carriers, and especially oil, gas, and petrochemical companies, join Iran's energy exchange on futures platform, Iran's crude oil and gas is capable enough to be turned into a benchmark for pricing in the region.
As Iran has the largest oil and gas reserves in the world, the pricing benchmark for our gas and oil should not be elsewhere. The fact is that we should have our own pricing reference for our natural gas in the region. We hope that with the launch of futures and cooperation of all companies in the field of oil and gas, such a thing will happen.
Futures are some very important instruments for the market balance, while they are also some strong hedging tools. They provide investment opportunities for those who are seeking the amount of profit more than they can earn in the normal market deals.
Futures contracts are financial contracts obligating the buyer to purchase an asset or the seller to sell an asset at a predetermined date and price in the future.
The launch of futures trade markets at Iran's energy exchange will contribute to transparency and the predictability of Iran's economy. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
(laughs)
The Islamic Jihad movement held a national conference for women in the Gaza Strip on the occasion of International Women's Day. The conference, titled Woman is the Icon of Resistance, highlighted the role of Palestinian women in fighting the Israeli occupation and their struggle for freedom and justice. Palestinian women in the Gaza Strip paid a heavy toll during Israel's war on coastal enclave last year. According to human rights groups, the Israeli regime killed 60 women and 22 children in 2021.
We are supporting our women. We called the international, we addressed the international human rights to support our women, asking the international committee to protect the women, to protect the children, to stop the occupation forces against the women in Palestine.
Addressing the conference through satellite transmission, Islamic Jihad Secretary General Dr. Ziad Nakhala praised the role of Palestinian women and their struggle against the Israeli regime for more than seven decades.
Palestinian women will not allow anyone to stop her resistance, consider it to be a red line. Palestinian women share military and political struggle with men. Palestinian women has given a lot for her homeland and abroad.
Conference attendees discussed ways of developing new strategies for women to confront the Israeli regime and its illegal practices, especially against women.
Palestinian women today meeting in Gaza to discuss about the role for women, for Palestinian women, and to discuss issues about how to defend the Palestinian in Palestine.
The annual event also tackled ways of bringing international attention to the plight of Palestinian women.
Palestinian women say that they will continue their struggle against the Israeli regime until the liberation of Al-Quds and all of Palestine. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
United States Secretary of State Antony Blinken wrapped up a visit to the leaders of six European nations, plus a visit with the European Union and Israel's foreign minister, with a closed-door meeting with French President Emmanuel Macron. Washington has just announced a ban on Russian fossil fuels, but Blinken has apparently not convinced the European Union to immediately sever energy ties with their primary supplier. Russia announced they would cut its oil supplies to Europe if they introduced energy sanctions, which would have a devastating economic impact, perhaps globally. In what many say is an effort to avoid peace and increase the likelihood of a major war, Blinken recently announced that NATO members can send fighter jets to Ukraine. The U.S. and Europe have already provided significant military aid to Ukraine and imposed sanctions so potentially sweeping that Russian Federation President Vladimir Putin recently said they were, quote, like a war.
France is not directly concerned in this conflict, and yet they've already overdone it. When their foreign minister declared an all-out economic and financial war against Russia, that is an act of war. However, there's no economic coherence here because Europe completely depends on Russia for gas, petrol, and titanium, while the loss of export sales to Russia would be a catastrophe for European agriculture.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky recently announced that he, quote, understood that NATO is not prepared to accept Ukraine, end quote, which appears to be a concession to one of Russia's primary demands to end its military operation. The risk of expanding the conflict is a major concern, and with Washington giving Russia a cold shoulder since their offensive, Macron has served as the West's primary mediator with Moscow.
Macron has failed in his mediations because he and Germany have not been able to convince Ukraine to respect the Minsk agreements. If Macron had been able to convince Ukraine of this, then things could have been quite different. France should have been able to achieve this, but the United States obviously didn't want it.
Since 2014, some 14,000 people have been killed in Ukraine. Russia's offensive on February 24th has produced almost 500 civilian deaths and nearly 2 million refugees, according to the United Nations. In recent years, many politicians have argued that the European Union is necessary in order to have peace on the continent. However, forming an EU army, sending arms within Europe, and waging a sanctions war, which is sure to hurt the Russian people, doesn't seem peaceful to many. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his immaculate progeny. Dear brothers and sisters all around the world, assalamu alaikum and welcome to yet another edition from series of Q&A in Islamic beliefs from IRIB English Radio. Dear brothers and sisters, if you have been following this series of shows, we are trying to answer the doubts and misconceptions on the Islamic beliefs which are received usually in the form of questions from different questioners from around the world. The question of the day is about the validity of some narrations and a hadith. Dear Sheikh, it has been asked that it's true that we almost 14 centuries have passed from Islam and we are talking about narrations and a hadith that has been narrated from Imams and the Prophet. So how can we trust all these hadith and let's say narrations after this long period of time? And you see, when we are going to narrate a part of history from 30 years ago, we have different forms of narrations of the same event, which has not even passed a long time from that, and even our fathers or grandfathers have yet witnessed those events. But we are talking about the hadith that came to us from 14 centuries ago. Are they validated and can they be trusted to actually tune our lives based on them? This is a question that has been asked by a respected questioner.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You see that about the authenticity or validity of the narrations that we have a lot of hadith corpuses and different collections of ahadith in different and various books of Shia school of thought or, for example, Sunni school of thought. We cannot ignore this huge heritage, Islamic heritage. You see that talking about the ahadith and narrations, whether from the noble Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessing of Allah be upon him, or his pure progeny, or for example, for the Sunni school of thought about the companions of the noble Prophet or Tabi'in, we have a lot of numerous, hadith corpus collected these Islamic heritage.
Yeah.
Of course, these ahadith before the verses of Noble Quran, they are some source for understanding Islamic learnings and Islamic teachings. And of course, we have beside that wisdom and the consensus. But after all, these Quran and hadith are two and main parts of the Islamic sources. You see that for checking the authenticity of narrations, of course, we have Ilm al-Rijal.
Yeah.
You see, Ilm al-Rijal talking about the single narrators of the, you know, talking about the chain of the narrations. For example, Dhurara from Muhammad ibn Muslim, Muhammad ibn Muslim from other narration, from other narrators, and so until it reached to the Ma'asum, infallible Ahlul Bayt, or for example, according to the Sunni school of thought, to the companions of the Noble Prophet or Noble Prophet himself. For example, we have Qurb al-Isnad for some of the hadith core path. You know, these Qurb al-Isnad, mostly we have, for example, three or less maybe narrators till the infallible Ahlul Bayt. Mm-hmm. You know how close this Qurb al-Isnad is to the infallible Ahlul Bayt. Of course, we have different hadith or different chain of the narrations till the until it reaches to the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam themselves. You see that about this ahadith, this Ilm al-Rijal, as I said, and because it is very important, I just want to repeat myself.
Yeah.
This Ilm al-Rijal check single narrators of that specific narrations. Yeah. Whether that person, for example, was authentic one or liar, whether that person was, you know, was able to quote the exact version of narration or not, which we call it dhabt.
Yeah.
Whether that person was, you know, has this ability to remember that and to have the ability of tahammul al hadith, which means to have and to memorize this narration and to pass it on to another, you know, narrator or not.
Yeah.
And beside this ilm al rijal, we have ilm al diraya. Ilm al-Diraya talking about, again, chain of the narration, entire chain of the narration.
Mm-hmm.
Whether this narration is sahih, muwathaq, hasan, da'if, mursalat, different kinds of the... I'm not able to explain all the, you know, explanation for the ahadith. For example, which hadith is authentic or sahih? Which hadith is considered to be weak? Because we have different, you know, bases for that, you know, and different presupposition for whether this hadith considered to be muwathaq or not. And what is the definition of muwathaq? What is the definition of hasan, mursala, maqtu'a, muzmara, and so on and so forth. Numerous explanation for ahadith. This is a responsibility of ilm al-diraya. And after that, this diraya check the content of the narration and then goes to the tahammul al-hadith, which means the ability to quote the narration, okay? And adab naql al-hadith, which means the, you know, etiquette for quoting the narration. I just want to emphasize on the point that maybe our dear questioner was not informed about the different sciences for hadith, hadith sciences, because these sciences talks about the authenticity of the narration and the contents of narration in a way to the extent that we become 100% sure that that particular narration is authentic or not.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is no shadow of doubt that that particular narration is authentic or not.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Inshallah, inshallah, inshallah.
And how come about what the comparison that this person is making that says, for example, a part of history or event that happened 30 years ago, and there are different narrations of the same event, see? So which one is the most reliable narration of the same event is something that sometimes the people get stuck with that. So how can we tell this brother that the knowledge of hadith differs with the knowledge of, let's say, narration of the history of the, let's say, modern or even old time?
Even for the history that you mentioned, we have some ways for understanding that whether that's part of that history is authentic or not. For example, talking about the history of the Karbala or the what's happened in the land of Karbala about the day of Ashura and before that and after that, we have numerous books which has been quoted the story of Karbala about the massacre in that land. Okay, in a way that we become sure that because it has been quoted frequently, which we call it mutawatir, it has been frequently quoted, we become sure that that particular event has been, occurred in that time. Okay, and of course, in the historical point, we have a lot of example for that, in a way that we become 100% sure that that particular event was occurred. Okay. I want to say that in different, for example, in history, we have some ways for understanding of that. In hadith, we have different academic way, wise and acceptable way for checking the authenticity of that narration.
You pinpointed some of the knowledges of hadith, like that of Rijal and the knowledge of knowing the validity and reliability of a hadith, and you talk about different forms of. Can you please briefly introduce these knowledges to get informed that okay, there is some series of, let's say, processes that happens on a certain, let's say, word or let's say hadith that comes from the Holy Prophet to reach us. So it's not that easy to say, okay, this hadith is mutawatir, is accepted, and the other hadith is rejected. So this is not something that can easily be done. So it goes through a, let's say, lengthy process to reach the conclusion.
Exactly. You know, when you want to check what authenticity of one narration, I remember that in the, some scholar, they spend maybe some weeks for checking the authenticity of one narration.
Yeah.
Whether this narration is authentic or not, okay? True. They check single by single narrator of that, the chain of that narrator, okay? And they went to the biography of that narrator. And they check even the, for example, descendant and the parents of that narrator. I mean, all things which are relevant to that narrator, which we call it Ravi, in order to check whether that particular man was authentic one, can we rely on his saying or not? I mean, it's not easy task. We should spend a lot of time and energy in order to understand whether this narration comes back to the, an infallible individual or not.
Okay.
And this, I mentioned that this is a branch of science. Maybe knowledge, maybe we call it, ulum hadith. And of course, here in Qom, at least, we know some of the institutions that are working on ulum hadith and the sciences related to hadith.
Yeah.
As I said, it has three branches at least. First of all, dirayatul hadith. I explain what does it mean, understanding the narrations. It has an explanation to that. And after that, rijalul hadith, talking about the narrators and the chain of the narration. And then we have Rivayatul Hadith, how to quote the narration, what is the etiquette of that, and so on and so forth.
Very true.
I want to say that if you want to become an expert and to understand whether this narration is authentic or not, it requires a lot of study.
So, supposedly, a hadith has been scrutinized by the experts of hadith, for example, belonging to a denomination, let's say the followers of the school of Ahlul Bayt, is the outcome and output of this group valid and also trustworthy for the other denominations to refer to? That is, whatever comes an output of, let's say, hadith sahiha or correct hadith or let's say reliable hadith, an authentic hadith. So can it be also accepted by other Islamic denominations or only valid for the followers of the same sect?
Of course, basis and mabani, which we call it basis, for checking the authenticity of ahadith.